From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Phil Cousineau really, really loves words. In his new book, The Painted Word, A Treasure Chest of Remarkable Words and Their Origins, that passion comes through as Cousineau digs deep into history to find the origins and stories behind words ranging from Abbey Lubber, which means a holy lazy fool, to Jihitsu, which means a spontaneous jotting down of one's thoughts. We'll talk with the author about his latest love letter to language after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of our forum program. Bay Area author Phil Cousineau joins us in studio for this forum hour. He's the author of over 30 books, including Word Watcher, which we discussed with him on forum. And that book was named as one of the best books in 2010 by National Public Radio. Deepak Chopra calls him a word wizard, and the late Joseph Campbell described him as a five-tool threat, a writer, filmmaker, photographer, editor, and teacher. His newest book is The Painted Word, a treasure chest of remarkable words and their origins. Phil Cousineau joins us in studio. Welcome back to Forum.
Good morning. Great to be back, Michael.
Glad to have you back here. The word that was coming through my mind as I was reading through this new book of yours, and it's also one of those really good-sounding words, is polyglot, because the origins are so varied in the English language. I mean, you know, you get into, well, the polyglottishness of the English language. It's unavoidable, isn't it?
Polyglot, many-tongued. Isn't that wonderful? And yeah, I was struck by the fact a group called the World Word Forum a few years ago had a major announcement that the 1 millionth English word had just been accepted, Web 2.0. and they went on to say that one reason English has so many words as compared to French, for example, with roughly 250,000, German with 500,000, it's impressive, but 1 million English words, it's because it's this enormous river like the Amazon with hundreds of tributaries flowing into it. And what are the tributaries? It's the words that we get from the immigrants, people coming from cultures all around the world, boondocks coming from the Philippines, duende coming from the Spanish gypsies. And
but I discovered in your book that boogeyman comes from the Philippine Islands, and you mentioned, what's the second one you mentioned?
A boondock.
No, and then you just said
a duende.
Which comes from?
The Spanish. It's a great word that Lorca brought back to describe the blood surge that comes up from the ground that every artist has to get into contact with. That's that extra oomph that you get in blues music or the flamenco dancer. And so it's become a powerful word used in circles of poets right now. The X factor, we might call it, but duende sounds much better.
Well, you love the sound of some of these words. I think that's part of the appeal of, I think scrutinize was one of your favorite words, as I recall, and just sometimes the sound of, even onomatopoeia, yes, which is in here, and some of these words sound very much like onomatopoeia. Some of these words are just so obscure that you, I mean, it's, I guess, The Painted Word sounds a little bit like The Painted Bird by Jerzy Kosinski, but you're talking about words that are colorful in large part, aren't you?
That's right. That's right. The first book, Word Catcher, was one in which I was exhorting people to try to catch words that catch their attention. Repeat them. Write them down. Use them in a conversation. I loved listening to the Giants this year, and a batter lays down a bunt, and the pitcher lazily comes off the mound and throws the ball to first base. And it's too late. And so Mike Kruko, rather than saying he was lazy, he said, oh, he nonchalanted that play. Now, that's a colorful way to look at language,
that's
right?
That's what we call a neologism, though. He's inventing a word there, isn't he?
Exactly. Yeah. Coining a word right there on the spot. And that's why I've worked with Greg Chadwick. He's created a number of covers for me, and he did 60 illustrations, beautiful works of art here. His work is available here in San Francisco at the Sandra Lee Gallery. And the first time I met him was in North Beach. We sent our boys to the same preschool, and he told me that he loved poetry. He read poetry when he was stuck with painting. When I'm stuck with my writing, I love to go to movies or art galleries. And he quoted an obscure writer, Suetonius, from the second century, who had said, painting is silent poetry. Poetry is painting with words. And I love how the two of those intermingle. John Updike, who was also a great painter, by the way, he had once said that the itch to make dark marks on white paper is shared by writers and painters alike. So what do we remember? We remember colorful language. My son the other day was looking in the mirror and he screamed out at my wife, "Mom, there's a jungle growing in my nose." He's 16 years old. That's a wonderful, that's a memorable expression, right? Another friend of mine, Norwood Pratt here in San Francisco, is a tea maven. And he was once describing how some people were leaving a meeting very quick. And he said, "Oh, they absquatulated." And I had to go and look that one up. It's an old Civil War era term to describe how people leave very quickly.
I have to look back at Updike's paintings. That's yes. What I have to do. No, I mean, he was a great writer, but I don't remember mm-hmm. him as a great painter, although I know he did paint most of his life. But this can lead to a lot of confusion, these unusual words. There's even a word for that, xenolexia, right, where you get confused over the meaning of words.
Well, that was constant confusion. This is my second book of words, but I've looked up words for every lecture, every film I've worked on. I'm hosting a show on PBS now called Global Spirit. If I'm about to interview somebody and I look in my interview questions and there are words I'm not quite sure about, I have to look them up. Interviewing somebody about the search for the ecstatic, I go back to the Greek. It means standing next to yourself, being out of your body. So that helps. The revelation for me was after looking through scores of dictionaries, there is very little consensus. When someone says, "Oh, I think I'll look it up in the dictionary," which one? Merriam-Webster? Thorndike Barnhart? Is it the OED?
Well, the OED is more my Bible. And yes. I read you very much like I read the OED because you mm-hmm. get into etymology, you get into the way it's used, you see where it comes from and how it evolves and so forth. And that's all very useful to those of us who love language and who are interested in derivations and how language is used. But some of these words, I must tell you, you know, I have a pretty decent lexicon. As a little kid, I used to look at Increase Your Word Power and the Reader's Digest and all that kind of stuff. But, I mean, there's a word here I can't even pronounce. We used to say anti-disestablishmentarianism. This is hydroactive philharmonica. I don't know what the heck this is. The glass harmonica, the bull organ. You got words like gongzoogle. I just marked some of these down. You were talking about tea before. Murky and picked.
Let's tease those apart real quick. Have you ever wondered when someone is at a party and they wet their finger and they run their finger around the rim of a glass, what does it do? It starts to sing. It's magical. Everybody stops. It's kids to adults. One day I was wondering if there was a word for that. That's just the way my mind works. I wonder if there's a word. And it turns out there is this hydrodactyl psychoharmonica. It goes all the way back to the Greeks. And essentially what it means is you're looking for the music of the spheres when you run your finger through water. Ben Franklin actually designed an instrument after this, and it has several different bowls and glasses of different size with different measures of water, and he could perform sonatas with this. So to me, that's delightful, and that's what
delightful.
I'm trying to do with the book. Yeah, I want it to be delightful.
Well, in fact, I found myself delighted at, since you're talking about instruments, highfalutin, which goes back to the steamboats and possibly even Mark Twain. That is, it's from the high flute sound of the steamboats, and as you describe it, it gets into some very curious, and I found this in a few of the words that you adumbrate for us. There's a good word. Give us the kind of nuances and shadows of. There's the sound of the steamboat, which had to do with the way poor people heard it, because the richer and more affluent people went on the steamboat, so highfalutin. And then I noticed in your book the word villain, which also has a kind of class division to it. People who lived in the villa as opposed to those who didn't live in the villas.
Social distinctions are one of the great surprises of doing work like this. Highfalutin apparently comes from the notion of people on rafts, which also gives us riffraff, by the way, riff being an old word for oars. So the riffraff were the poor people pushing themselves down the river like Huck Finn and Jim. And what are they doing? Occasionally they're passing by steamboats. So just imagine these poor people on rafts looking up at these classy, magnificent floating opera houses, right? And what often caught their attention were the high flutes of the smokestacks. And when they would look at the smokestacks and the billowing black smoke, they would see people all dressed, all hoity-toity and so on. And they took the high flutes of the smokestacks and then eventually transferred it to refer to all of the rich people, the aristocracy, the highfalutin people, people who put on airs to look down on other people. And there you have a whole revelation of the class system.
And where does hoity-toity come from?
Oh, that one I wish I knew.
Uh-huh. You just used it in the sentence. We'll have to go search for that.
We'll
be a
word
catcher.
Sure.
There's even some when you talk about the word biscuit, for example, and a story about a guy with a doorknob. You want to tell that? Because, again, it's revealing of class differences.
That's an interesting one for me because it's an example of the extraordinary in the ordinary. Biscuit's a word that we use constantly, biscotti in a North Beach cafe. It goes back to Roman shipping times when they were able to evolve ships to be able to travel further and further and further away from Rome and the Roman Empire. They had problems with food stores. How can you store food to feed sailors who were now going to be gone a few months? So they would begin to, they would bake bread twice. Biscuit means twice baked. So you could store this and then bring it out a month later, 2 months later. And so I told a friend of this, R.B. Morris, a great musician in Knoxville, and he said, oh, God, that reminds me of the times when I was really struggling as a writer. I've caught my daughter looking at the doorknob and thinking that it was a biscuit. She was so hungry. Now, that's a colorful way of using language. That's what this is all about.
And we're talking to Phil Cousineau. The book is The Painted Word, A Treasure Chest of Remarkable Words and Their Origins. He's also the author of Wordcatcher. And like you said, the artwork that you see on this book, quite colorful, like so many of the words, is by Greg Chadwick. You realize so many words come from sources that are very obvious that you don't necessarily think of. Like Rome, when you roam around, is from Rome. When you canter on a horse, is from Canterbury. These are things that just are so obvious. And what also comes across in terms of the obvious is words that we don't even think of in terms of their multiple uses and how much they're used. I guess run is now right at the top of the heap, isn't that right?
Yes. And that's one that brought me a great delight. I was reading an essay by the great Simon Winchester a few years ago in the New York Times, and he made this observation that when the last complete version of the OED, which is now going online as we know, published in 1928, came out, the lexicographers, as they call them, did their study and they found that the word set.
Lexicographers,
thank you. The word set had the most number of meanings of any word in the dictionary, roughly 200. And then he compared the recent editions and looked for the word with the most meanings. And it's run, R-U-N, which has roughly 650 different meanings. And now Winchester goes on to extrapolate, which is what I like to do. What the heck does it mean? He says, set gave you an idea of what the world was like in between the wars, just before World War II. The world was set in its place. We were set in our mores. It was a comfortable way to think of ourselves and culture. But today, we're all on the run. We're running from one thing to the next. And so there are more and more. We have a run in our stockings. There's a run on the stock market. You score runs in baseball. It seems to be metaphoric of how the world has changed, gone from a set way of things to a world that's running amok, so to speak. Another good foreign word.
You think about how things have changed. I'm reading your book and suddenly, you know, we talk about loopholes all the time and we talk about taxes. Little did I know, it's an archery term originally.
I loved that one. I've been to 100 castles in my life traveling all around Europe, and I always looked at those narrow window openings. And of course, we've seen them in 100 Hollywood movies, right? And looking up the word loophole once, thinking I knew what the meaning was, I was astonished to find out that it refers to those tiny windows that just allow the archer a few seconds to release an arrow through the narrow opening, but then he can pull back so someone can actually put an arrow through there. Archery gave us another term that is delightful for me, first string. I played a lot of ball, first string basketball, first string baseball, and so on. It goes back to an old archery term. The first string was the first arrow that you pulled out of the quiver. Now, isn't that delightful?
Well, it also makes eminent sense. Yes. But you need to know those things to realize how sensible they are. In fact, I was talking before a moment ago about the origin of words being so different. You got Lakota words here, Maori words here. I mean, you know, in some of these more obscure words, but the breadth and the range of etymologies is just amazing. And I was actually listening to an interview you did in another radio program. It was in Chicago. A guy was talking about how certain words have become so much a part of our lexicon that we take them for granted. And he said, well, my father was Jewish, and like kibbutz and kvetch, these are such commonly used words. And I thought of I remember Scott Fitzgerald said that he would hang around Jewish delis, because he loved the word knish, just the way it sounded. I mean, there's certain words, just the sound of them draw you in. And a lot of them have become, well, customary in the English language. I mean, they're different sounds. They're almost alien sounds when you think about it. You mentioned hors d'oeuvres, for example, you know, and there's a Jack Benny story in there, which I really enjoyed, which I'll have you tell. But this is a word that we, like the name Cousineau, you know, certainly a French name, but hors d'oeuvres, people just use it, maybe don't even know where it came from.
Right. It means literally outside of the work, and it was originally a literary term of all things. You would be doing some work just to pay the bills, and you would be doing some work for literary.
Well, you talk about the oeuvre of an author. It's right in there.
That's right.
In there,
But the perfect example of what you were just saying, copacetic, which is a word Roy Blunt Jr. has coined the word sonicky. Sonic, but sonicky to describe a word that rings wonderfully on the ear. Melodious, euphonious, great sound words, right? And so there are many derivations of copacetic.
It's associated mainly as a jazz word. Jazz musicians always used to use it, but the roots go way back before that.
Hundreds of years old.
Abraham Lincoln or something?
Even before that, probably another Civil War era tone term. But David Mamet, the legendary playwright, has a theory that it comes from an old Yiddish term, kol beseder, which meant all is in order. And his theory was that there was black customers who knew the word copacetic, who were coming north for jobs and for playing jazz, actually, in Chicago and Detroit and Kansas City, going to Jewish merchants, maybe to get a suit. And so the old Yiddish term combines with the jazz term to give us the word copacetic. Now, that's word detective stuff, right?
Well, and you thought, I guess, a lot of these Yiddish words came from Tin Pan Alley and from actors and playwrights and certainly screenwriters. And I mentioned Jack Benny. I think his real name was Jacob Bialowski, by the way.
Memory serves me.
It says, Jack Benny gave this definition of hors d'oeuvres. Hors d'oeuvre, a ham sandwich cut into 40 pieces. That's classic Benny. And we're talking, by the way, if you just joined us, with Phil Cousineau, and his book is a lot of fun. It's called The Painted Word, A Treasure Chest of Remarkable Words and Their Origins. And let me do this. Let me ask you, our listeners, to join this conversation. I mean, there may be words that you delight in, that you find colorful, that you find particularly enjoyable or are drawn to. I mean, words can be like magnets. You might want to just join us and let us know what some of those favorite words are, what you love the sound of in particular words, or find especially colorful. This is sort of Phil's life work, at least part of it, even though, as Joseph Campbell said, five-tooled guy. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786, and you can join us now, and we welcome your calls. Again, toll-free from wherever or however you're listening to us, 866-733-6786. There are a number of other ways to communicate your thoughts about language, or maybe even there's some word you want to catch the meaning of or want to find the origin of, and this is a good place to at least get that underway. In fact, I'm going to tell you about hoity-toity in a minute here, because Judy tracked it down. But you are welcome to join us on going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or email us, forum@kqed.org. And couple of other ways, embarrassment of riches in terms of ways to communicate, go to our Facebook page or tweet us. And our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. And let's, Judy, you just put it on my screen, I thought. I have to go back up on this. I've got it here, I think, don't I? Hoity-toity. Snopes on hoity-toity. Comes from an obsolete 16th century, Phil is taking notes here, verb, hot meaning. Wait a minute. Hout. Hoit, H-O-I-T, which means the fool. Hoity-toity used to be used to describe silly, frivolous behavior before coming to mean pretentious in Snopes because there's a false claim that it comes from the French, help me with the pronunciation here, hautois. H-A-U-T-T-O-I-T.
Hauteur,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or high roof, actually, is what that means. Hautot. Toi, okay.
I love it. That's wonderful. And that, it's what I recommend to people. If you hear a word that makes you smile, you're not quite sure what it is, be humble about it. Three of the hardest words in the English language are actually, I don't know. But that can be the urge to go to the dictionary to look it up.
You just stated the thesis of my last book, but we won't even necessarily go there. Let me go to the callers here. And wait a minute, what happened here? I think we're... all right, we've got... I don't have the name here, but the caller from the East Bay, that's you. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Yes, sir, go ahead.
Hi, my name's Alyosha.
Alyosha, that's a good sounding name, yeah.
Yes.
Ruski, yeah.
Yes, and I'm a therapist, and my favorite two words I discovered, a number of years ago at the same time, triterature and cacistocracy. And triterature I understand to mean the act of slowly grinding down as with a mortar and a pestle. And cacistocracy I understand to mean government leadership by its worst citizens. So I think if you have a cacistocracy, you have triterature.
Boy, that's good. Thank you for that.
That's a good link. Also, it's the old Greek cacistocracy originally referred to thieves, so it's government by thieves, people who are stealing from the populace, which is what I think about when I go back to my hometown of Detroit. My God, this is a place that has been ravaged and pillaged by politicians over the years.
In fact, you got a new word because of the porn ruin?
That's astonishing to me. I was back there working on a new documentary about old Tiger Stadium and how people are going every Sunday afternoon to groom the field and still play on it, Detroit's Field of Dreams. But there are hundreds of photographers, filmmakers, video makers from around the world who are going there because it's a kind of modern, it's an American Pompeii, an American post-war Berlin. So they're taking photos of the destruction, 50,000 homes burned to the ground. And now Detroit is feeling a little defensive about it, and they've coined the term ruin porn.
And by the way, let me give you a plug here, Phil. Phil Cousineau will be at Book Passage at the San Francisco Ferry Building today at noon, so you can actually meet the author and other bibliomancy. That's the word, actually, that I connect you with Ansel Adams, right?
I'm not sure about the Ansel connection, but I love the notion that it's a divination through books. It's an old practice, goes back to at least Virgil and the Romans, where you would begin your day by riffling the pages, a wonderful verb, right? Riffling the pages of a book that you feel great respect for. It could be the Bible, it could be the Aeneid, the Odyssey, Unbearable Lightness of Being. And you take a word
could
or
be
a
the
phrase.
Painted word. In
could
fact,
be the painted word.
We'll continue. We'll find out what words you love and what words you maybe don't know the meaning or origins of that you want to find out and what words are colorful to you. That's all what we're talking about here on this hour of Forum with Phil Cousineau, whose, again, book is The Painted Word, A Treasure Chest of Remarkable Words and Their Origins. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Phil Cousineau, a logophile and proud of it. That means he really, really loves words, and he's here in studio with us. He'll be at Book Passage at noon today at the San Francisco Ferry Building. His book is The Painted Word, A Treasury Chest of Remarkable Words and Their Origins, and we want to find out what remarkable words you are interested in or particularly are drawing to you. But first, let's touch on a couple quick things with Phil. You were talking about campaign. I mean, you thought you knew the meaning of that word, but found out, well, you didn't.
That's exactly the impulse I'm trying to encourage in the readers for a book like this. There are some words that are simply baffling. You use the word gongoozle. It's a word that describes the phenomena in England of people going next to train tracks or on trestles and staring at trains as they go by. And it refers now to anybody who stares for a long time into thin space. I love the sound of that. When I teach kids about the fun of words, they love that. They take that one home. So I'm listening to the elections, as we all are, NPR and KQED, everybody. Campaign is the word that comes up again and again. I think I know what it means. It sounds a little familiar, campagna, French for field, right? So I look it up, and this is where the splendor of language comes through. Remember, the Irish poet Patrick Kavanagh once said, "Let words laugh." Isn't that a wonderful impulse to describe doing radio interviews or writing books? And it turns out campaign refers to the field in which competing armies faced each other to go into battle. That's magnificent to me because that's exactly—
Two warring camps,
Democrats and Republicans and so on.
Can you explain to me perhaps the origin of a word that our president uses incessantly? Folks.
Oh, gosh. Don't know that one. You're right. That's a good one.
Well, we've got our homework ahead. Let's go to our callers.
This is good. There are a million words, and we're getting through them.
I don't know if we'll get through all of them this hour, but let's get Philip on here. Philip, hi.
Hi, thanks. Two questions. One is, can you say something about individual coiners of words?
Individual what, Philip?
Individual coiners of words.
Oh, coiners.
Yeah, I have heard that Shakespeare, for instance, was the most prolific coiner of words in the English language thus far. Can you talk about him and talk about some other famous coiners of words? And two, can you talk about the legacy of colonial words, words imported from colonies during the colonial era? For instance, the words bungalow and juggernaut are actually Indian words and were brought back by into the British sphere of language.
Well, in response to your first question, there are thousands of words and phrases that come right out of Shakespeare. I don't know, Phil, you want to gloss that a little bit more and talk about colonial words too?
A couple of things. First, Shakespeare is by far the logophile with the words most credited to him, around 1700. Just imagine that. Imagine having coined 1700 words that people use 500
daily.
Years from now in a daily basis. Sir Walter Scott, of all people, is in a close second with 700 words. Colonial words, I think of two that come from the Civil War. Deadbeat refers to those who were fleeing battle. Beat used to be a word to deceive or swindle. So this was someone who had conscripted into war, didn't like what he saw, and tried to flee. That was where the original deadbeats. And deadline is someone who worked as a journalist from the time I was 16 on is a word that's always riveted to me. And it refers to the no man's land in between the two fighting, the North and the South, for example.
But those are Civil War. He was talking about colonial. I mean, you go to juggernaut, it does go all the way back to colonial times and came, as he said, from India.
Juggernaut refers to these enormous wagons that were pulled by elephants in old Indian rituals. And sometimes those who wanted to sacrifice themselves in front of Krishna would throw themselves under the wagon, which was called a juggernaut. And we now use the word to describe anything that has a kind of colossal momentum to it that could crush you.
There are so many words, though, that probably came via the whole, you know, across the pond from England, from India, I mean, and even pre-colonial times that have just become embedded in our language and are a natural part, again, of everyday speech.
And it behooves us, it rewards us to look at them.
There's a good one. That goes way back, too.
I love the word easel because we have – I'm working with Greg, a wonderful painter here. It turns out easel is an old Dutch word for a donkey. Now, what would the connection be with that. Can you remember some of the old photographs of Cezanne and Van Gogh, some of the others?
I might make an ass out of myself guessing on this one.
Well, it refers to the equipment that the painters would take with them out into the countryside that they would put on the back of a donkey. And the donkey was an easel. So the name from the donkey that carried all the painter's equipment was transferred to the actual wood frame. Now, that puts a smile on my face.
Your enthusiasm is infectious, as many have said, and about language. Let's go to more of our callers. And Sarah, hi.
Hi. This past summer, we were in Paris and Berlin and noticed groups of teenage boys, mostly, speaking in their native tongue and then swearing in English. And they would use the F word and the S word constantly. And it got us thinking about the origins of swear words. And I'm wondering if most languages have used the F word, their version of the F word and the S word, and how do they all disparage their mothers somehow? You know, she's the... You know, just I can't even mention them on the air, but using phrases that disparage the mother, is that common in other languages? Thank you.
I hadn't thought of it that way before, but one thing comes to mind quickly, and that is that the word for mother in languages around the world, other than Japanese, is invariably a word that begins with M. There is something primal about that word, and it possibly has to do with what the infant is doing at the mother's breast, is puckering, and mwah. What sound do you make when the baby is puckering? Mwah, ma, ma sound. So ma gives us mother, but also myth. Myth is the
it's
mother's
like the first sound
story,
made,
yeah. The very first sound.
But I think on the other, I may have a little bit of light to shine on that. It's... I don't think there's anything quite that profane Oedipally outside of maybe the African-American experience where it's very common. You know, there's been a lot of attempts to by black comedians and so forth to say, let's not use this anymore, like the N-word. But it goes back to Africa. It goes back to the dozens game where, you know, you would insult, let's say, another person, usually male on male, and you would insult the mother, and you could take it so far, and then it would become very dangerous, you know, because you don't insult the mother. But that particular word, I don't think I've encountered in any other culture. We asked listeners, by the way, to share favorite words with us on social media, and here are a few. Ramon says, gobbledygook. Just love the way it rolls off the tongue. Steve writes, my favorite word has to be petrichor, or petrichor, the scent of rain on dry earth. Amazingly, I first heard this while watching an episode of Doctor Who and have been using it ever since. Megan tweets, I love the sound of perish and perplexing. Somebody just said to me recently, don't you love the sound of asphyxiate? the way that's a, here's Anita who writes on our website, I've always loved the sound of evanescent. It seems to fade away on the tongue. Bill from Sevastopol writes, after futile attempts at nymph chasing, Pan would retreat to his cave and emit a plaintive wail of grief and loneliness that was so terrible it would send any human who heard it into a panic. And so, so many of these words come from mythic sources. I mean, you mentioned narcissism, for example, I mean, which is a disorder like, well, Oedipus complex from Oedipus again. But, I mean, these are common words that we take for granted, and they usually have many of them sources. Now, here's one that you have in your book that Gary brings up. Gary says, here's a word which I find extremely useful, common among people I know, and which to my ear really sounds like what it means. Oddly, as common as the word is, I can't ever remember hearing it in broadcast media, and the word is funky. And you have a whole thing about, I mean, the music and so forth, funk music, yeah.
Right. Originally, it had the notion of bluesy, soulful. It goes all the way back to the 17th century French. Funkier, which is smoke in it, and then also a smelly, rotting cheese. Now, how would that possibly get us to James Brown? Probably.
People say they smell funky. They do.
Well, you feel how the voice goes down, funky. And what is it doing? It's bringing your energy down to where? Down to the ground. Funky, the way that we use it, is get down. You don't tell Aretha or a Baptist singer to get up. You tell them to get down. Funky always has to do with getting real. As we would say in Detroit, the greatest thing you could say about someone is, he's real. Get real. Get down. Get grounded. All of this is in the word funky.
And James Brown. Fact, a number of years ago, I had the privilege of introducing B.B. King at the winery down in Saratoga, Palmasan Winery. And he came out and he said, let's hear it for little Michael. And I, you know, he's a big guy. And I'm thinking, God, you're making me seem small here because he's really big. And again, in the intermission, he said, let's hear it for little Michael. And I'm like, why does he have to do that? You know, calling me little Michael. Years later, I was interviewing a blues musician. I told him a story off air and he said, don't you know what little means to blues people? That's about one of the highest compliments you can get. And I thought, wow, that's nice. Nice story.
That's a great one. Sound is the way I think we remember words. Did you ever yell a certain word when you were jumping off a diving board?
Geronimo.
One of my favorite words in this new book. It's one of those I thought I knew what it was, didn't, looked it up, and that wall-to-wall smile came on my face. It comes from 1940. A group of paratroopers in training in drop school to go to fight in Europe. As part of the Esprit de Corps, building the Esprit de Corps, the U.S. Army shows a movie about Geronimo one night, played by an Indian named Chief Thunderheart. And apparently the jumpers were so enthused about hearing the name again, Geronimo, again and again in the movie, that one of them, a guy named Aubrey Eberhardt, said, all right, tomorrow when we go up into the plane, I am going to yell this name as I'm jumping out of the plane. So he did it. And it's apparently sounded so cool. There we are again. It sounded so cool.
Sound of it, yeah.
It was the name of it that all the other jumpers used the same word, and the word spread out, and jumpers all through World War II used it. When they came home, they start to raise families. They tell their kids, yell Geronimo when you're jumping off a diving board.
Do you know who Chief Thunderthud was, by the way?
No.
This is for old-timers out there. You said Chief Thunderheart. Chief Thunderthud was on the old Howdy Doody show. There's a great trivia question. I should have left it out there. Let's go to our caller. Stan, you're on. Hi, Stan.
Hi, Michael. It was a great show. What's the origin of the word pusillanimous?
Pusillanimous means cowardly, and it has to do with the shriveling of the soul.
Shriveling
of the soul.
So it's a spirituality term.
Yeah. And it became a perfect word to describe someone who recoils, who shrivels in the boxing ring, who shrivels from a fight or a debate. Isn't that, that's what the body does, right? When you expand when you want to fight, take something on, but you shrivel when you're scared or
you usually
uncertain.
Mean it about somebody who's very timid or is cowardly.
Timid, that's right, yeah. It's a great sound again.
Yeah,
it is. It's one of those words that when you use it, people say, huh?
Well, there's also a word that Phil takes up in this new book that I always like the sound of, and it kind of sounds like what it means. Like sesquipedalian is a great word because it means, you know, using words that are polysyllabic and long words. But mellifluous, you know, it has that sound to it, almost lyrical. And it literally means honey-tongued, you know. And it sounds honey-tongued, mellifluous.
Right. And the flow of honey. That dawned on me one of the first time I was ever in Greece. And I asked for some honey and a jar came and it had the Greek lettering. And then right underneath it, the word mel, M-E-L. And I did one of these head slaps. Oh, my God, this honey, mellifluous. So it's the words that come up flowing like the honey you pour in that great Greek yogurt.
I read some emails here. One of my favorite words, Mona writes, is susurration, which one reads not infrequently in the works of T.C. Boyle, a soft whispering or rustling sound, a murmur. I imagine it as the sound of a soft breeze through aspen leaves, a wonderful word. More from listeners. Here's Brad who says, I'd love to know the etymology of hornswoggle and bamboozle. My favorite is sabotage. From the sabots, wooden clogs that disgruntled workers put in the gears of machinery. I'll be gruntled if you answer this. from Benton. You know about hornswoggle or bamboozle?
Right. We get a surprising number of words from our maritime history. Hornswoggle was a word used by sailors to describe being thrown from one side of the ship to the other in bad weather. And later on, seeing the metaphor behind a word, which is often how words evolve, and that's why they stay rather than being thrown overboard, so to speak. Someone who is trying to fool you, trick you, throw a hoax in a business deal is hornswoggling you because he or she's throwing you from one side of the deal to the other. Bamboozle actually has its origins in Chinese, and it refers to teaching people to swim in ancient China by putting bamboo, small pieces of bamboo, which are hollow logs, right, underneath the armpits and underneath the legs.
They do give us fun, don't they?
In fact, you never know.
I think I said earlier, I know one of your favorite words is scrutinize. Now, nobody would have identified that with rag pickers, but that's the origin of the word, the Roma people.
That's right. And it sounds great, but it also is one of these, it's a textural word. And it comes from a principle that I use again and again in Wordcatcher and also in this, The Painted Word. It's the whole power of observation. When you are looking closely at the world, like someone had to, picking through old rags to find good rags, often which would then be sold to the paper mills. Remember, our earliest forms of paper came from crushed, pulped rags. So you're looking through something, a rag that would actually bring some money back into your world or your family. So you're looking closely. The metaphor is there. So we all now scrutinize.
Let's scrutinize some more of your calls. We go to Robert. Robert, you're on.
Hi. I wondered if Michael or Mr. Cousineau had ever heard of an early Tom Wolfe book called The Painted Word. It's a brilliant discussion of how critics, art critics, Clement Greenberg and Harold Rosenberg in New York, through language and words, had fostered helped to foster a whole abstract expressionist movement in the city, people like Jackson Pollock and William de Kooning. It's a wonderful demonstration of how words can affect outcomes and realities that would otherwise perhaps not ever develop.
Boy, it sounds like a book I'd like to read, Robert. Do you know it at all, Phil? I don't.
I do. It's a wonderful book. Published in the late 70s by Tom Wolfe of the great white suit and the white hat, the white.
Although when I interviewed him last, he had on a blue suit. But
right?
So this title you could take, it's in the public domain now? Or?
Oh, sure. He used it to describe the art market in New York in the 50s and 60s. But I thought it was very appropriate for use here because when we're trying to communicate to each other, but in a visceral, memorable way, we try to paint our conversation. So we say, okay, I'm going out with some fancy people to Nob Hill. I'm going to hobnob tonight. That's a fun word. It's a fun word to remember.
It's got that local root to it, huh? Nob Hill?
Originally, it comes from England, and what it refers to is going into a pub and asking for your beer either warm or hot. You could have your beer on the hob, which is inside the fireplace. It would cost a little extra money to have it actually warmed up. Or you could have it from the knob, as in the knob that pulls the beer from the kegs underneath. So the hobnobber was the one who could afford more expensive beer.
Well, actually mentioning Nob Hill and all that, Jenny from Napa says, you've covered a slew of words my Midwestern mother always used. Are there regions of this country which produce more colorful words than others? And by the way, where did catty corner come from? I think we're going to have to look that one up. You know, Phil is close to a million here, but there are maybe a few hundred that he doesn't have easy reference to. But regions, fascinating. I mean, so many of our words do come from the Midwest. Many of them come from the South. Who's got a dominance? Is there a dominant region in this country?
The dominant modern words are coming from California because of the world of technology and Hollywood, but also our shipping traditions here in North Beach and on the coast. Originally, it was probably Southern words gave us more colorful language.
Originally, there's no doubt that it was from the South. Yeah.
And then New York with the Yiddish contribution was fantastic. Schmier is an old German word that actually means to cover something like a bagel with cream cheese, and we still use that today.
In fact, I remember reading in a linguistic journal once about Faulkner has these characters named Snopes, you know, Montgomery Ward Snopes, and they're essentially interlopers, and they're people who are dreadful. They're more like utterly commercial-minded and materialistic and not obviously favorites of that great Mississippi writer. They're a whole clan. But the word Snopes has the SN sound, which is often a pejorative, snarl and sneak and snake and so forth. And Yiddish, you know, all these schnus, like well, Shusta, you know, Schmendrick and Schlemiel and Schlemazel. I mean, they're all sort of like the snuh sounds in English. I mean, pejorative. Anyway, Rob writes, I've always loved the word serendipity, which to me sounds just like what it means. Rob also writes on Facebook page, pulchritudinous is the ugliest word I know for pretty. Actually means beautiful, in fact, pulchritude. Michael from San Rafael says, I love this one that I've read about the origin of the word Dixie. In the 1800s, I don't know if you know this, Phil, I certainly didn't, the French in the Louisiana area printed their own currency, as did many in other parts of the country. Others who frequented the area read the French word on the $10 bill by pronouncing the X in Dixie. In Dix, excuse me, D-I-X. They began to call these notes Dixies, and the name stuck for the whole area of the South. Christine writes, kerfluffle, perfect word matching meaning. And again, there are so many of those. More favorite words that we asked. Will tweets, please talk about finut. Lorenz's word of choice, gluttony, instead of gluttony. No? Do you know finut, F-A-N-U-T-E? Well, we're finding more that neither of us know here. Ken writes, my brother liked to say sesquipedalian is a very long word. By the way, the sentence is an autological tautology. And we'll go to more of your calls. Chris is joining us. Chris, hi.
Hi. Hey, I have three things. Great, love the show. First of all, favorite words I have and some encouragement for our youth, and then a quick question for you. I love the word onomatopoeia because it's sort of self-referential. It's a word about the sound of the way the word sounds like. So what a great word to mean the words that sound like what they are. So onomatopoeia.
Buzz. There's the example people always give of onomatopoeia. Buzz. Sorry.
Yeah, it does. So here's a word of encouragement. My 11-year-old daughter, they've made up words at their school. I don't know if everyone's heard about this word. It's called you can pwn somebody. And it's spelled P-W-N-E-D. It must come out of the tweetosphere or something, but it means to be subservient to someone or to be owned by them. Have you heard about this word, to be pwned?
Not yet, but that's one that could last because it turns the corners of your mouth up. It sounds great. P is always a funny letter. P-O starts to make you smirk. Joe Biden used the word malarkey a couple of weeks ago in a speech. And apparently the websites for all the dictionaries caught fire because most people don't know today what it meant. My grandparents used it. It's an old Irish word.
I heard it as a kid. I think, you know, it's just gone. A lot of words just go. Yeah.
But it's encouraging to know that so many people immediately had this impulse to go and look it up. Here's a funny new one that I learned in Dublin just about a year ago. I'm walking into a pub with an old friend, Jazz Lynch, and we pass a dozen people or so, young men and women, smoking and talking to each other on the curbside. And my friend Jazz says, oh, don't worry about them. They're just smirting. And I had to stop him right there. Oh, wait, stop. What does that mean? He means they're smoking and flirting. What was happening? Other than trying to bring peace to the Middle East, I thought the hardest thing in the world would be to stop smoking in Irish pubs. But 2 years ago, they did pass a ban. It didn't mean that you didn't stop smoking. You couldn't smoke inside, so you walked outside. And when you're outside, smoking on the curb, what do? You start to have a conversation with somebody. You chat them up, as they say. A new phenomena, a new form of behavior always calls forth a new word. This is one of the principles in language from the get-go. So this is a new form of behavior, and a new word comes about. That's funny. It sounds good. Smirting. Another recent one I love is infonesia. According to Atlantic Monthly, information is increasing about 14% every year. So you'll say, so Phil, where did you find that definition? Michael, where did you get that quote from Milo Kundera? And if you say, well, I don't quite get it, you've got infonesia. Amnesia of information. It's a word that's coming up because we're all feeling inundated by information.
It'll be quickly part of our lexicon on a regular basis, one of those kind of words. Canoodle, do you know where that comes from? You're talking about pub activity and see people canoodling in pubs in the UK and they use that word freely. But
it's an old Anglo-Saxon word that means to cuddle.
Yeah.
Right.
And here's Dan who says, I was watching the Frank Capra movie, Mr. Deeds Goes to Down, and Gary Cooper uses the word doodle to describe someone scribbling absentmindedly. I looked it up, and it turns out, at least according to Wikipedia, that movie introduced doodle to the English language.
I love it. See, now that gives permission to people to make up words. Maybe they'll stick. Maybe you'll be mentioned in the OED someday.
Well, we'll get another caller on, and that's you, Steve. Hi.
Yeah, hi. PWN, Pwn. It's a misspelling of own, O-W-N. Either comes out of the video game or the hacker community, like we own you, except the guy mistyped. And everybody thought it was so funny, they decided to use it.
And boy, it caught on, didn't it?
Oh, definitely. It's kind of like that old expression of all your base are belong to us.
Thank you, Steve. I keep thinking we should bring back the word swiv. You know this word. It's in Chaucer. It's a Middle English word. Because we'll be careful to clean up the act here. But when you talk about sexual union, sexual intercourse, there are only profane words, it seems, or clinical words. Swiv is one of those words that's neither profane nor clinical. We need that word.
It sounds graceful. Here's a great story. You know, climax is actually Old Greek for ladder. And the inference then was picked up by the Scottish woman Maria Stopes, who was a pioneer of birth control, and she wanted an alternative to the very clinical dry cold word orgasm. So she went to her dictionary and she found the word climax. Why? Because it brought pleasure to the word. Orgasm has no real pleasure in it. So this is a way in which you are invoking something probably deep in our DNA where we have a kind of folk memory of the origin of our words. Anglo-Saxon, the Norse, a good word like ordeal comes from the torture practices of the Vikings. Do we have time for one more?
I think we're short on time, and I just wanted to give Steve a chance here, who from Petaluma says, Lewis Carroll coined 21 words in his Jabberwocky poem alone, 8 of which have made it into contemporary English dictionaries. He mentions chortle, a combination of chuckle and snort, and I want to mention that because you were talking about how words combine that way. Well, always a pleasure to have you here, and thank you so much for being with us. Phil Cousineau's new book is called The Painted Word, and again, you can meet the author. He'll be at Book Passage of the Ferry Building at noon today. We're here with you, as I said before, Monday through Friday, and the program goes from 9 to 11 with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. It's produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED, by the way, continue this on our website, putting down words that are colorful to you or that entrance you or enchant you or that fascinate you. Just by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And again, for all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.